nearly 70 years of continued safe, judicious use to improve cattle growth efficiency and really make the most out of the resources that we have available to our beef cattle. And it's only gotten better. We've got more doses, duration lengths. We can use them in different stages of production and really through the entire life of a critter from weaning until right before harvest. We have an opportunity to use this technology that, like you said, easy napkin math is a lot of times a 20-to-1 ROI. And so if you think about it, you're spending $2 and you're making $40, and oftentimes it's even larger than that.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Mycotoxins can threaten feed and cattle performance. DSM Firmenich offers a portfolio of solutions to help mitigate the impact of mycotoxins in your feed. bioMérieux is a world leader in the field of diagnostics for more than 60 years. From pathogen detection to genomics and data applications, bioMérieux helps beef industrials going beyond the test results to help control your food safety and process risks. Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.virbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Be proactive with Cattle Active. Visit proearthanimalhealth.com today.
Welcome to the Beef Podcast. I'm Travis Mullenix, and today I have Dr. Zach Smith. Welcome to the show, Zach.
Hey, Travis. Thanks a lot for having me.
It was good to have you back on the show, and I think we have a really good topic on hand. That something I know from a technology standpoint is probably our best technology that we have today. You're talking about return on investments is implants.
There's no doubt about that, Travis. Steroidal implants with anabolic activity, they've been a tool in our beef production tool belt since the early 50s. Late 50s, some of the implants that we use today were approved and brought to market. What I'm talking about is now marketed and sold by Zoetis is Synovex S, but this got its initial approval back, I believe, in 1956. And so I've been doing this nearly 70 years of continued safe, judicious use to improve cattle growth efficiency and really make the most out of the resources that we have available to our beef cattle. And it's only gotten better. We've got more doses, duration lengths. We can use them in different stages of production and really through the entire life of a critter from weaning until right before harvest. We have an opportunity to use this technology that, like you said, easy napkin math is a lot of times a 20-to-1 ROI. And so if you think about it, you're spending $2 and you're making $40. And oftentimes it's even larger than that.
So in a production setting, you know, when do we implant or when should we be looking at implanting?
So there's a couple times where we can implant. I typically think of implants as a suckling phase, growing phase, and then a finishing phase. So in theory, a critter could receive up to four implants during the course of their life. In successive use of those implants, they're additive at each stage. And so if you give a calf hood implant, a suckling calf implant, and let's say you enhance weaning weight 16 to 20 pounds, that's going to carry over to the rail. That 16 to 20 pounds of live weight that we generate at weaning on those critters is going to be 8 to 10 pounds of added carcass weight. So in today's market, it's $20 to $30 a head that we're talking about just from a calf hood implant. And on top of that, if we're going to talk about calves, you know, there was some misconceptions about people saying you don't want to buy implanted calves. And this really is old sale barn talk that has lasted for generations. Most recently, though, some work out of Kansas State, Dr. Glenn Tonser, he surveyed a bunch of the Superior livestock data lots and controlled for whether those cattle were sold in a program that forbid the use of that technology. And when you take that out, the price premium for calves that we're going to call affidavit cattle that are in a program that you're going to get a premium for not using an implant, actually implanted calves brought more money. And I think it's twofold. Either the next person down the supply chain buying them knows they're going to get that added carcass weight when they sell them. But even as another bonus is, if I'm buying calves and he's got an implant or she has an implant, I know that thing was restrained and probably got his vaccines that he needed too. So there's a lot of things there that probably make a difference in that.
It's a guest reassurance of their management prior to coming in, right? It's like a preconditioned calf.
Yep. Yeah, you know they were doing other things right.
Correct.
Sure.
Right. And so if they're implanting, you know, you have a pretty good idea that they're vaccinating, they're handling correctly, they've been preconditioned, et cetera, and up going down the chain. And so it just gives you that reassurance of what you're buying.
Yeah. And, you know, we know a lot more now about how they work, what they do to carcass quality. Equal days on feed, implanted cattle, the implants delay fattening. So they're going to not have as much marbling. They're going to be leaner. Might be the same weight, but you need to feed them a bit longer. And now, I mean, we feed exclusively continental English crossbreds. We use every bit of technology, calf hood during the dry lot phase. And in the finishing phase, we'll give them two implants. And those things, they grade 90% choice or better, 5 to 8% prime. They're good technology. Now, on the other note, since I've started, man, we feed cattle. We used to could get two turns of cattle a year, about 150 days, maybe take a few weeks to scrape pens. But we feed them longer. They're bigger. What I started, 120-day studies, now 160-day study, because we just don't call the packer till they weigh 1,600 pounds.
Yeah, it's interesting how the market has not pushed down on carcass size yet, and it's still driving for larger carcasses.
Well, and it's been 6 pounds a year on steers, literally every year since 1962. We might have, and then the carcass weight discounts, they just keep allowing more flexibility on those. When I was a meats judger 14 years ago, anything over 950 was not good, and now it's 1050 to 1100. Yeah, and so might as well rock with it.
So going back to the producer side of this is, why do you believe, you know, because this is one technology, it's been around a long time, like you described. The adoption rate is not there on the cow-calf side. You know, yearling side, it's still hit and miss on guys that graze. Feedlots, what is it, 95%?
Oh, 90, yeah, at least. We have a joke. There's only two things that are like no questions asked in feedlot production. One's ad libitum access to water, and the other is you give them an implant if they're not in a program that gives a premium for non-implanted cattle. Everything else, the forage level, forage type, grain processing, those are all debatable, and there's no right or wrong answer. Probably it depends upon management, but yeah, they need water. And we're foolish to not use an implant. I think on the cow-calf side is a lot of it might be the old sale barn talk. Generations of we've always done it this way. I do think another thing that's important to think about, at least on the cow-calf side, is, you know, you got to have some groceries in them for the implant to work. It's all right. A percentage response. So if they're only gaining a pound pre-weaning, that implant might only give us a 10% improvement, and they get higher as we go through production from 10 to 20, sometimes even up to 30% improvements in gain. So that 1/10 of a pound is nearly immeasurable after a long suckling pre-weaning period. The other thing that's really important that I think a lot of people may or may not realize when they're using this technology is that the age of the dam really matters. And you can appreciate this, Travis. Pritchard and Dr. Taylor did some work back in the early 2000s where they looked at the age of the dam. So under four, so imagine a wet three-year-old's calf. She's still trying to get to her mature weight. Her milk production potential is not, and that's what that calf's eating early. So spring calving herd, you implant in May on a younger cow, she's not probably cranking out the enough milk production likely to support that growth. A mature cow, so past two to three parities. So, two parities or greater, she's rocking and rolling on her milk production at the time when that implant is paying out and needing to support growth. So one management strategy where if you were to use all your cows in the same pasture and you implant the young cow's calves and the older cow's calves, those young cow's calves may not respond to the implant purely because she's not producing enough milk to support the growth. And so if you manage the herd where maybe the younger cows are in a different pasture and the older cows are in a different pasture, which I think that's pretty common in production, you just need to wait to implant the younger cow's calves till about August. By that time, he's probably eaten some of the forage, any other supplemental feeds that are going out, and you can get that weaning weight response. So when Pritchard implanted the young calves in May, they didn't get a weaning weight response. But when he implanted those calves out of the young cows in August, they got a really nice weaning weight response. And it was all about groceries delivered to that critter. So I think a first strategy, I don't do a lot of talking to cow-calf producers, would be, all right, let's think about the cow herd, age of the cows, and when we're going to apply this technology to see the most benefit. Because it's one of those things, it's not a disruptive technology in the sense that it's a set it and forget it. But it does take work. It's different restraining techniques. And so it kind of like tarping a silage pile, like it's worth it. You don't have 50% dry matter losses. But if you do it wrong and you don't put enough tires on it, it blows away and you wasted $8,000 on a cover, you're probably not going to tarp your pit next year, especially if you're not like a dairy, just a feedlot or a cow-calf guy that just needs forage to truck cattle along.
Yeah, the timing is very important from that aspect of, you know, highly energy dependent, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so when energy is limiting, then you're not going to get the benefit of the implant or get a little benefit of the implant.
And we don't have that problem in the feedlot. They're on a progressively higher energy diet. Now, I have on purpose screwed these things up. We were looking at a study where we were kind of controlling intake. We capped intake early on for the first half of the feeding period to about 92% of ad lib of the full fed group. And when you implant those calves the day they arrive to the feedlot, you kill quality grade. But if you delay it 60 days, we were trying to do some feed saving stuff. You get the quality grade and you get actually pretty nice responses. We used to think to give the implant as far away from harvest as we could, but that's actually not the case. You know, marbling adipocytes, they grow, they're a part of growth, not like sub-Q fat. Sub-Q fat is an exponential growth, but marbling adipocytes, they grow with the critter, oxidative fuel for red muscles. And you can screw those things up. But it's actually better to have the implant in, I'd say the terminal implant, the last 80 to 90 days on feed, because that's when they're the fattest. And they can use the most benefit from those anabolic constituents that we have in those formulations.
How has the new FDA changed, you know, it just changed when or the type of implants or the timing of some implants, right? And so how has that changed some of this?
It's actually, man, maybe it's made things simpler. If you think about it this way, a lot of this, some of the strategies maybe that we were using, we didn't know everything about them. There were 30 commercially available implants that you could use at three times, and we were sometimes using them two in each stage of production. If you think about 30 raised to that power, that's a lot of comparisons. So we'd never had head-to-head comparisons on how these work. A lot of implant studies, because they are valuable. People don't use negative controls. And when you do an implant study, it is very important to have a negative control to look at basal growth. You know, I have a lot of people tell me our cattle have such good growth genetics, we don't need an implant. But if that critter gains 4 pounds a day without an implant, he'll gain 5 when you give him an implant. So the new FDA rules, to kind of take you back to the stuff that I was hearing about, and man, this is actually the first time I've talked about this in public, because I really wasn't comfortable with, I didn't understand all the interpretations. And I finally studied up and you know, I know what we're doing and talked to some of my colleagues out in the industry and what they're recommending. So in December of 2001, the FDA issued an announcement that by July 2023, that the pharma companies that had beef cattle implants needed to put a label on there talking about whether or not they were approved for reimplantation within the same phase of production. And that was part of the deal. We had been using implants that weren't explicitly labeled, and there was not, let's just say, residues probably weren't an issue. But even we're talking about lower terrestrial species. Hormones are metabolized in the body. It's a good thing. It's why we don't have residue issues. In fact, implants have 0-day withdrawal. But they're excreted either through urine or the bile and feces. Cattle are primarily through their feces. And so we have to worry about these compounds potentially affecting lower aquatic species. So there's anytime these products are approved, they do go through what we call an environmental assessment. And they look at the accumulation of those metabolites in the soil and in feces and in urine. And that work hadn't been done with reimplantation. So we were, corrective action was taken by the FDA, and we were made aware of that. But the problem was, is we didn't know the various stages of production. You know, we knew there were suckling implants, there were grazing implants, and there were growing and finishing cattle. Well, growing and finishing cattle are actually where it gets the most confusing. Here in South Dakota, we could have done the Nebraska model and been in our corn stalks this year. Then they'd have been out on pasture. We had a pretty low snow cover so far. But a lot of our calves at weaning time are placed in confinement pens and they're fed forage-based diets until they reach the appropriate weight to be finished. But they never, ever leave locations. And so we had been, you know, using implant programs, re-implanting within maybe the same stage of production. In my mind, they were different. There was the growing period and the finishing period. And so they did some good work. The FDA came about and created what I'll call various stages of production. Now, the first one's going to be beef calves 2 months of age and older. That's the suckling calf, if you will. And there are some implants that you can use in calves as young as 45 days of age. Those are approved. They have label approval, but the broad category is beef calves 2 months of age and older. And in South Dakota, the next category is what the FDA would have described as growing beef steers and heifers in confinement. And we had them in confinement. And so the new rules were you cannot use successive implanting if they weren't approved for reimplantation. There is another category. This would be more of interest in Nebraska in the Southeast. These are growing beef steers and heifers on pasture. We kind of call that a stalker phase, if you will. And there's a whole suite of implants approved for the use in that category. We have suckling calf, stalker calf, growing and finishing in confinement. And in South Dakota, all of our growing cattle, a lot of them, I'd say, I'm going to pick this number out of the air, 80% of them are in confinement, in a confinement situation. There was one new area, a class of beef cattle that the FDA designated, and that was what we're going to call growing beef steers and heifers fed in a dry lot. And this opened up at the time when this ruling came out, the only implant approved for this compound was for this stage of production was Zarinol, so commercially known as Rougro. It's marketed by Merck Animal Health. But this is a subset of population of growing beef steers fed in confinement for slaughter. These are weaned growing beef steers or heifers confined in group pens, fed a moderate to high roughage diet ad libitum as their sole ration prior to finishing. Also, sometimes the FDA has provided more clarification. They might be, so it's primarily forage, so greater than 50% forage, and oftentimes fed a supplement to support protein needs, so maybe distiller supplement. This is really the calf in Nebraska that's getting set up to go graze summer pasture. Not put in a feedlot and fed a higher energy growing diet and then put on a finisher. It's a wean calf in a dry lot that's going to go graze, probably leave the confinement area or the big open lot. Don't want to get into semantics. Maybe they're fed in bottomless feeders in a grass trap. And then they're going to go and graze pastures in the summer. And so that was really the one area of that was new to us on understanding where that fits in production. And in the eyes of the FDA, this isn't the cattle fed in confinement, 75% dry matter basis corn silage diet that then go on the finisher. The target area is this calf is being warehoused prior to going and grazing summer pastures. And then he or she will come back in late August or September and be that what we call the heavyweight yearling off grass that then it enters the finishing phase.
Did create some complications and understanding, you know, how this is going to work. Right. And so that was a little confusing when it was rolling out, is that what can we do here? Especially because it beef production system is not that simple.
No.
Especially when you talk about what you're just talking about is that winter backgrounding phase before they went back out to the summer grass. And so that's not a traditional backgrounding lot that would enter into the feedlot. And so what you would think is a growing lot or grow lot, you know, and so that makes it a little tricky.
And maybe some of those calves will go to the feedlot. Maybe they're too heavy to go out to grass, but not all of them. A lot of them go graze. Some of them might go to the, you know, it's like March, a certain way to calves here in Western and Eastern South Dakota, the prices go insane. These are the grass calves. Hey, but yeah, that was it seems fair. You know, we've just figured out how to work with it. Not using it's not good, but using them within a stage of production, it works. You know, I even think about what if they said tomorrow, no more, we can't use these. It would suck for one turn of cattle. I shouldn't say this. But then it would all be re-equilibrated. It would just be normal production. Hope we never get there, because they are a critical tool for food security, environmental sustainability, and really allow us to do a lot with a lot less. I was reading this book. It's the State Ag Experiment Station. It's cool. It was the centennial edition. Abraham Lincoln signed the Morrill Act in 1862, and the USDA started then. 1887, they came up with the Hatch Act, and that's actually how Travis and I do a lot of our work. That's state and federal funds to support research in the station. So really, while Travis and I like to support science across the United States and the globe, our first duty is to our stakeholders in our state. And in 1862, the average farmer supported about 4.5 people. 20 years after the land grant colleges were enacted, it was like 6. In 1962, this is after a depression, after World War, two World Wars, average farmer supported 26 people. That number, I don't know what it is today, but it's more than 26 people. And this all happened because of some pretty thoughtful people who were thinking ahead. Now, at the same time, this all occurred with McCormick's Reaper, milk separators, steel plows, tractors. It wasn't just the land, but a lot of that work did occur at the land grant institution and various, you know, whether it was the agricultural or mechanical arts, man, it is the coolest. It's actually one of the coolest things in modern history. Those people in 1862, man, they said, hey, feed ourselves. Most other, even emerging world powers, they don't have it figured out quite like we do yet. And so it's a pretty awesome thing. I mean, it's the coolest thing in the world, if you ask me.
The land grant mission itself it sets the United States apart from any other country.
They're 100 years behind us, easy. I mean, even on breeding cows, getting them bred and having That's why a lot of countries, their beef systems are based upon dairy because they need milk and then the byproduct, but they don't have cows grazing extensive rangeland and producing a 600-pound calf every year. They're taking dairy progeny, which is great too, but yeah, we got it made, man.
Well, but that helps advance science. And so, you know, implant is one of the multitude of technologies that has come out of the land grant mission and research that has really benefited production and efficiency of production. And so it would be a major loss in terms of that efficiency that would decrease if we lost it.
So I love history, man. That's why I'm reading that old history book. But, you know, in our business, and you know this too, I'm not super involved on the extensive range or cow-calf production. I had to specialize and I got lucky, right place, right time, and it ended up being feedlot cattle. But I really appreciate academic pedigrees. And my pedigree, Wise Burroughs, he was a scientist at Iowa State University. And I think he was on an airplane flying to Indianapolis or something to catch a flight. And Wise Burroughs, Dr. Burroughs is known for the urea fermentation potential metabolizable protein system. But he was also on a plane and he heard some executives from Eli Lilly. So Eli Lilly has an animal nutrition, an animal health company, Elanco, Eli Lilly Animal Company. And he heard him talking about this new compound that it was diethylstilbestrol. And it was in their human medical suite. They'd done some work in, I think, chickens or turkeys and noticed increased in breast size. It was an orally active molecule. That's really one thing about implants is the steroidal compounds. Most of them aren't orally active, which is a good thing. It protects us from consuming residues. But he said, wow. And he asked those guys, he must have got some delivered and did the first study in cattle. Oral diethylstilbestrol was approved, followed by implant pellets. I have a bunch of collection of old technologies, but this is some old school stilbestrol implants. We don't use them anymore. Those, you know, my mom, her mother had trouble conceiving a child. She took a DES to help with her attain pregnancy. And there was some issues with the babies from mothers of DES administered. They had a slight increase in uterine weight, and it was labeled as a carcinogen and pulled from the market voluntarily. Most of the ones we use now, we don't have that issue. And so get back to my story, man, I can get off track quick. Wise Burroughs trained a fellow by the name of Dr. Rodney Preston, another man that a lot of the people in beef cattle science know and respect. And Dr. Preston was involved with the early DES work all the way through to the Revlor implants in the 90s. And Dr. Preston trained my MS advisor, Dr. Robbie Pritchard. And my PhD was, and I didn't do implant work with Pritchard. I was playing around with chromium. And then Dr. Brad Johnson, he was at the University of Minnesota working at the time with Pete Anderson and then Dr. Bill Dayton. And they were some of the first folks to do to evaluate how these combination estrogen and trenbolone implants worked in beef cattle. So my pedigree, man, I'm only 3 degrees removed from Burroughs. It's kind of cool. So I've always been passionate about the technology. And we all have a similar story. It's such a small family tree that's got two branches off of it. So we all have, I'm not unique. There's a lot of people in that lineage, but it does, makes you proud that you kind of got lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time and kind of, learn off the shoulders of those industry giants and greats. And I'm just sitting here trying to think about what the heck I'm going to do that's going to make the world a better place.
It's always one step at a time. We never solve big questions at once.
So. No, I'm not going to change the world. I'm just going to try to do my part while I'm here.
Well, Zach, to wrap us up, any last remaining remarks that we didn't touch on?
Like I said, water and implants, if you're not in an affidavit program, really consider at the cow-calf level how you might implement that technology. The folks further down the supply chain do appreciate it. And the data would suggest they bring more money for the reasons we talked about. We knew the management was likely right. And just one of the best technologies that's available to cattle producers. You know, it's there's so many other things being thrown at us from a technology standpoint daily that sometimes that's stomping ants when there's elephants running you over. And we don't want to stomp the ants. We want to avoid the elephants. And using the implant is a way to really enhance the operational resiliency and sustainability by added weight of calves at weaning weight. And I appreciate when they have a calf hood implant, because that's going to translate into carcass weight when I sell them. If you're retaining ownership, that's going to be more weight when you sell them. The opportunities there are abound. I would like to see maybe we should get together and survey ranchers across the Western United States and South Dakota and say, what is the impact to use? I mean, it might be that in Montana, they can't go dig them out of the grizzly bear den, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are other reasons. It's not just coffee shop talk. When can you use it? So
it's time for our famous three.
Virbac, committed to growth. As fellow cattle professionals and veterinarians working with herds around the world for over 50 years, we know the challenges you face in the unpredictable world of caring for cattle. That's the Virbac difference. Whatever your herd size may be, we offer a new approach to cattle health, one driven by passion, knowledge, and genuine understanding of your needs. Our products are backed by on-farm research to ensure they help you thrive in the real world. In everything we do, we are dedicated to supporting you and the well-being of your cattle for generations to come. For more information, visit vet-us.verbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Virbac, committed to growth. For information, visit vet-us.verbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative. Virbac, committed to growth. As fellow cattle professionals and veterinarians working with herds around the world for over 50 years, we know the challenges you face in the unpredictable world of caring for cattle. That's the Virbac difference. Whatever your herd size may be, we offer a new approach to cattle health, one driven by passion, knowledge, and genuine understanding of your needs. Our products are backed by on-farm research to ensure they help you thrive in the real world. In everything we do, we are dedicated to supporting you and the well-being of your cattle for generations to come. For more information, visit vet-us.verbac.com/cattle or see your Virbac representative.
So I've got a couple optional questions here at the end. And so, for the viewers, what is a book that you highly recommend, a beef resource website that you highly recommend someone utilizing?
All right, I'm going to sound weird here, but I've somehow signed up for the Hordes Dairyman, and I'm not a dairy producer, but it's a really good resource of a different thought process than I use on some things about managing forage and cattle health. I read it every week that I get it. It's not a beef resource, but it is a cattle resource. And it sounds weird, but I love reading Hordes Dairyman. I don't know why. It's a quick and succinct. There's some really good articles in there and people that I'm not professionally involved with. So I feel like I'm learning something kind of outside of my scope. So that's one I've been using. It's a cattle resource. It's quick and succinct. I can read it after the kids go to bed, or I even bring it to the office and make the grad students read it. So that's currently been my kick, has been reading Hordes Dairyman. I don't know. Maybe other beef people aren't reading it, so I feel like I'm maybe getting a little more new knowledge. And then I really like checking out First Look in the journals. I think that's a good way. When the final edition comes out, there's hundreds of papers. But if you make it a part of your discipline or your daily routine to just see what's on First Look, it's a good way to only have to read two or three new papers at a time or scan them. and then save them if you like them for later use. Those are my strategies on literature that I'm presently reading and how I manage that.
The Horst Dairyman comment was surprising for a feedlot nutritionist, but
yeah.
I do read a lot of dairy stuff.
If the person that lived where I did before didn't order it, it's not even addressed to me. I just read it.
Yeah. You know, from a cow-calf side, especially in the Western Rangeland, I do read a lot of dairy stuff because of they go through similar metabolic challenges.
Yeah.
For different reasons. And so I get a lot of benefit from the dairy research.
Sure.
Just from a cow-calf side. So what is a non-beef or non-livestock book resource that you highly recommend someone reading, utilizing?
I need to quit brain rot scrolling. Sometimes I get onto my phone and just look at stupid content for too long. But I really, non-beef, I'm always interested in just history, man. And it's 2024, things like Google searches to just random questions have gotten better with AI. You know, I can remember the advent of the internet era. I mean, I was a kid. I remember Y2K. I was born in 1990. And I did graduate high school without a laptop. The next class all had laptops. And they could use Control F on their history notes and do the guided reading. But this is a pretty powerful tool. And I do not exactly know how to use it yet. But the information at the fingertips now with AI is crazy. I mean, in 2004, when I was finishing eighth grade, the internet was pretty good, but it was still pretty wonky. Websites were ugly. They were average. They had a bunch of HTML language that didn't always carry over and links didn't work. But man, I'm going to embrace the use of AI both as a faculty member, as a researcher. So non-beef, no, it's not a book, but, we should embrace the new technology that's available because it allows us to quickly synthesize new information. I asked it a question the other day of something that I'm an expert on, and it more eloquently and succinctly described what I, in like 5 words, what usually takes me 20 words. And so try it out, play with it, see what you can do with it. It still doesn't apply the knowledge. That's where we're going to be important. But the information's there, and it's pretty sweet.
It is. So lastly, what is, in your opinion, sets apart a successful beef professional from someone that isn't?
Oh, the key to it, at least in my life, has been good mentors and good colleagues. And you need to surround yourself with people that are smarter than you and that challenge your train of thought. My parents and my wife are good supporters. They always make me feel like I'm doing great. But professionally, man, you don't grow without a little pressure. And I'll give you an example. Even people underneath me, I've got a new postdoc here, and he comes from a different, really a forage-based beef system. And he's really challenged me on some things about the way I think and some of the things I'm doing. And so he's smarter than me. He's really good. And I'm just fortunate enough to work with him. So good mentors, good colleagues, they don't have to be your best friend. You're not going to be eating dinner on Saturday together, but they should definitely challenge and mold you professionally because we don't get any better in a comfortable setting. So good mentors, work with smart people, follow through, do things timely. Those are the things that have helped me be successful in working quicker than the person next to you, but providing a high quality product. I mean, it's such a small industry, man. I tell my grad students when we go places, it's like, you guys got to behave. And they're good kids. They get their free reception drink tickets. They don't need to go wild, man. It's such a small world. So your reputation follows you here. So keep your head straight, your ego out of it, and just work hard, I guess.
Great answer. Well, Zach, thank you for the time and the story on implants and your background. And so definitely a great technology. And I think a lot of benefits for the viewer to, listen in and learn about some, you know, some of the misconceptions of implants that may cause some people not want to use them. And so definitely one of the most underutilized technologies that we have.
No doubt. And just a side note, you know, reach out to your university personnel, extension personnel, beef cattle scientists. They're the ones that I would talk to on implant recommendation. There's some good vets out there, but the beef cattle scientists are the people you want to go to for the knowledge on how to use and when to use implants.
Yep, exactly.
Well, I do appreciate it, Travis. I've got finals graded, entered my final grades, and I have a checklist of about four things to do. And my family and I are going to head down to Texas for 10 days to see my folks, in-laws, nieces, and nephews. So it's always dead around campus this time. I think there's maybe a handful of people in the office today. So it's nice and quiet. Good day to get stuff done.
It is. Well, thanks again, Zach.
Thanks, Travis. Man, I appreciate it. Take care.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.